Chapter 3. Grass and Bonfire Smoke. When my father was a child, jobs were difficult to find, so my grandfather had taken a boat to Australia, hoping to start a new life for him and his family. Unfortunately, things went wrong along the way, and the rest of them never made it there, splitting up the little family and eventually completely losing contact. It was a huge loss for the three children, especially my father, who lost not only his own father, but also his role model. It would take many years before the children saw their father again. His sister took the long trip down under and, after much searching, found him in the Danish community in Melbourne. He had traveled around all of Australia, worked as a crocodile hunter in Queensland, gotten married again, and opened up a successful carpet business. His last name, Graugaard, was difficult for the Australians to pronounce, so he changed it to Jensen. Eventually, he made it back to Denmark for a surprise visit 17 years after he had left, staying with family in the other end of the country to rest for a week before heading to Copenhagen. My father heard through an uncle that he was there. Without a second of waiting, he jumped on his motorbike and drove it directly across the country. He gave his father a surprise call when he got to the little town. His voice was trembling, and his Danish accent was long gone, worse now shaped strangely by the land far, far away. He said he was coming to Copenhagen the following week and asked if my father was there so he could maybe come and see him, if he was welcome. He answered that he was not in Copenhagen, but stood in a phone booth just 100 meters from him. There was a pause and probably a skipped heartbeat or two. Years later, newly in love, my parents were on their way to visit the family down under. My mother was a young secretary and my father an electrician. His shirt was often half unbuttoned and he was wearing a gold necklace with a cross around his neck. He wasn't religious, but I'm sure he thought it looked ace. Australia must have seemed unbelievably far away back then. Today, going there could be arranged on the couch in 5 minutes with a credit card and an internet connection. My parents had to order the tickets by phone through a travel agency on the other side of the globe. It was handwritten, sent by mail, and had 7 stopovers on it. I still have it. My father had brought his gi and black belt, looking for a few places to train. I can only imagine what an adventure it must have been to sit there in a strange land, flicking through a phone book to look for a gym, then finding the courage to pick up the phone, call them, and try to speak with them in a foreign language of which he had little practice. April 4th, 1982, I made my grand entrance in the world. My parents moved out of their apartment and spent all their savings on buying a small house in a beautiful little suburb of Copenhagen. It was made of red bricks and had a garden, green hedge, and a playhouse. A red Opel with a back seat I would eventually fill up with Donald Duck magazines and breadcrumbs was parked in the driveway. The summer was warm that year, and the young new family had high hopes for the future. 3 years after me, my little brother came by, a gentleman challenger, along with myself, in the official competition of who had the whitest hair in the world. My life was pretty much perfect when I grew up. I rode my bicycle alone to school every morning. We made tree houses in the forest, bonfires in the garden behind the house, and played football on the many empty streets of the sleepy little town. I always seemed to smell of grass and bonfire smoke. My classmates were nice, my teachers were inspirational, and I did well in the school that was right across the street from the exciting forest with so much to do. I couldn't wish for anything more. The mythical land of Australia and my family there played a big role in my early life. Every year at Christmas, I received a big brown cardboard box from Down Under, filled with exciting things from the tropical life I could have lived and heard so much about. Candy, toys, teddy bears, photos, and a blue eraser shaped like Australia with the flag printed on it. I had it in my pencil case for years in school, always saving it and using the other ones I had instead. Our house was small but filled with exciting things to do for a young boy. There were trees I could climb and secret holes in the hedge to our neighbor's mystical gardens. Apart from a few appliances and a scary storage room with just a meter to the ceiling where you could only climb on your hands and knees, my father had pretty much taken over the basement of my childhood home. He was an artist, handyman, soldier, inventor, photographer, and a black belt in both karate and taekwondo. In my eyes, there was nothing he couldn't do. In one of the rooms, a heavy bag was hanging from the ceiling and an old rusty barbell with a few metal plates lay on the floor. Even though I was told it was dangerous for my back to use it, I often tried to lift it anyway whenever I managed to sneak down in the basement alone. There was a dark room for developing photographs. The walls were black. Big, exciting machines I wasn't allowed to play with stood in one side of the room. Large plastic trays were lined up on the long table along the wall, and above my head were lines full of wooden clamps and wet photos hanging to dry. There was a very distinct smell in that room. The chemicals from the plastic trays couldn't possibly have been healthy for me to breathe in the many hours I spent down there, but it was a fair trade-off for a lifelong passion for photography. I was obsessed with computers. We had our first one, an IBM PC with 2 5.25-disk floppy drives when I was around 6 years old. I tried to learn everything I could about it. It was quite necessary in order to make any use from it, since it was complicated and not very user-friendly. Programming became a serious interest for me, and I threw myself into exciting projects such as encryption algorithms and a network chat system for the school's computers. I wrote several issues of Computer magazine at the age of 10 when we got our first printer, sold a stunning 15 or so of them in school and at my mother's workplace, and made my first website before I had ever even been online on that new exciting thing called the internet. In fifth grade, I got a job teaching an IT class every Tuesday. They paid me a 7-up. But that was only until I hacked their administration accounts and got banned from using the computers for the rest of the year. Apart from computers, martial arts was constantly on my mind as a kid. There was nothing I wanted to do more in life. My father had started training in the beginning of the 1970s when Bruce Lee's movie had created long lines outside of the first karate school in town. Later on, Korean karate became the new craze and the rivalry was on between the styles. He always told me many stories about his training. The competitions back then were full contact, and many times did he have to fight his own friend and roommate. They met in the finals of the Danish championships and beat each other so hard they had to carry one another up the stairs to their shared apartment when they got home. I must have asked him every single evening when he came home sweaty from practice when I could begin myself. At 7, I was finally allowed to start training taekwondo. My father was teaching in the gym, so I'd already been there several times before. I also knew many of the techniques from home, so standing in the back of the class on the hard wooden floor with my nude little white gi and stiff belt tight for the first time, everything felt very familiar. Already from day one, I was determined to learn this thing, to become really good at it. Every Monday and Wednesday evening, I walked down the cold, stone-covered stairs to the room in the school's basement. The sound of the big wooden door opening echoed down the empty hallway. It was scary in the dark when the school was closed, so I always hurried inside. The gym had a certain smell, a scent of carpet, and the wood from the desk and little office that one of the members once had built. On a couple of sofas in the corner, we looked at pictures of Bruce Lee in black and white magazines with beige pages and corners neatly folded at least a decade earlier. We were more than 40 kids in the startup class that season. After a few months, only half of them were left. There was no way I was going to quit. As the years went by and we progressed in the ranks, it was only me and a handful of the others that were still training. I took pride in not stopping, even though it was boring sometimes. It was easy for me to learn the techniques and pass the belt tests. On the wall outside of the changing room hung a frame article from a national newspaper about one of the kids from the team that had gotten his black belt at the age of 10, the youngest in the country. I didn't think about that it was easy for the kids to progress in the belts back then. The amount of dedication and hard work I put into each belt made it worth it for me. White, yellow, orange, green, blue, red. The diplomas from each one of them, the proof of my persistence, were hanging on the wall over my bed at home.